you know, I always have found that if you want to be good at something, you find people that are good at something and right. find some of those things that are working and see what you can emulate and go from there. And so I pulled out three reeds, I laid them on my leg, and I started going in one direction as one small bull, another direction as a medium bull, and then another direction as a bigger bull, and trying to make it sound like a little, you know, basically three bulls that were communicating and were going to start moving into each other, you know, just amping up. I don't know why I did it at that point, but I was like, I've got to hold him for a second. So I screamed a bugle with the diaphragm as I drew. And when I did that, he stopped. And this was the first time that I discovered elk have a fatal flaw. That is that when they want to see something or to see what spooked them or see what scared them, they almost always stand broadside and turn. When you throw out a location bugle to another, and another bull hears that, he's got to decide whether or not he wants to engage with you. And right. sometimes they just don't want to engage, right? And he's happy in his situation. He's got his cows are around him. He knows where they are. Because a lot of guys think when they're being answered by a location bugle from a bull or herd bull or bull that's, you know, that has his cows moving, is that that bull's talking to him, and they're not. They're no. just sounding off where they're at so the cows know, right? If people start to think how they would if they were someplace and you're tired, you're hungry, do you want to go up on the side of a hill, you know, or do you want to find the best path to move through? And elk move the exact same way. They are masters at saving energy yep. unless they're in a situation where they have to do something different.
Welcome to Days in the Wild Big Game Hunting Podcast, brought to you by Phoenix Shooting Bags. A couple things before we jump into this episode. Please, you heard me say a million times, go give us a review on iTunes. Helps me keep this podcast free and helps with the ratings. Also, go check out Phoenix Shooting Bags. If you use our promo code JohnStallone, all one word, you save 20% off on anything. And it's not just shooting bags. They do glassing pads. They're working on some other really cool stuff coming up here for the hunter, bow hunters also. So go check them out, phoenixshootingbags.com. And if you're looking for a really good hunt, I have some really good opportunities for you. Hit us up on daysinthewild.com or check out my blog, johnstallone.me, and send us an email. If you're looking to do a coos deer hunt, javelina, mule deer in South Dakota, we got some opportunities in California as well. So give me a call if you're looking to do something different this year and like to get on a special hunt. Days in the Wild Outfitters, and we'll take care of you. Without further ado, let's jump into this episode. Everybody's so entitled, you know, like they're above everything, and it's, they feel like they need to get paid. Let me just give you an idea. Like, I got service guys that work for me. The guy who makes the least makes like 60 something grand a year, and then my top crews are making like 100, 110. Like, where are you gonna go?
Right.
And clean pools, you know, clean and repair pools for 100 grand a year. Like,
that's freaking unbelievable, dude. Yeah, I'm right? I taught school for 30 years and, you know, never made above 50 grand.
So. Yeah, right? So, and you had to have college degree and all that stuff to do that. Like, you could,
yeah, absolutely.
You could be a beauty school dropout and clean a pool, you know? It's like, it just kind of cracks me. And listen, it's shit work in the summertime, but it's also the easiest job in the world in the wintertime. And you're still getting paid the same year round.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I mean, I got a bunch of good guys that have been with me for a long time, but it's trying to get past that hump and grow. That's been difficult. Like, every time I hire somebody new, it just doesn't work out. They're like, I don't know. They look great on paper, and then you throw them out there and they suck. But anyway.
Yeah, no, I hear you, dude. It's yeah, you almost have to crop them like like, you know, farm them out. But then,
well, that's what I did for a long time. Actually, mm-hmm. I would hire guys as helpers and stuff, and mm-hmm. then they'd work underneath at Master Tech for a year, year and a half, and then I'd grow them a route nice and slow. But because things have been going the way they're going, I it's hard for me to do that now. It's like those are all the guys that are still with me, you know, they're all the guys that were all working under somebody else for a long time and then got their own route, you know. It's just the new help sucks. I don't know. I think it has a lot to do with this. I blame a lot on this. You know, in the 90s and stuff, we started doing the whole participation trophy thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
that whole mentality. It's not just that, but the whole mentality that everybody is, everybody's special. Regardless if they do anything special or not, you know?
So having coached for 34 years,
mm-hmm.
and you know, all of a sudden there's no tryouts anymore to make a team, you know, so
yeah,
you're going to take that? Everybody. I'm like, what the hell is that all about, man? You know?
Yeah, that's fine for PE, you know, where people just need to learn and be active and whatever, but you know, you don't become an NFL player because you're of a certain class of person or whatever. I don't even want to I don't even want to be unpolitically correct right now, but it's like, yeah, you got to bust your ass, man. You got to be the best of the best. That's how you get to there.
Yeah.
And if there's, you know, there's no push for you to do that, how are you going to become the best of the best?
No, absolutely, man. That's why people don't have persistence anymore. They've never had to really go beyond without somebody feeling sorry for them and giving them an out. Yep. You know, it's all this friggin' enabling. And that's one thing that I love about some of the things that I'm involved in. That's one of the, at least in sports, you know, even with all that underlying things, you know, you get at the right level with high school kids, it's going to end. And it's not going to end the way they want it to all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you learn those lessons that, you know, you bust your butt, you take the rewards out of it, and there's things you're going to take from it that, you know, whether you come out, you know, only so many people are going to win a championship trophy,
right?
So,
yeah.
You know, there's other things you're going to gain from that, and hopefully it's those skill sets that are going to carry them off, and they're going to take into life and talk about, just like you and I are right now, that you just got to work for crap. There's no magic wand.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you know, it's all compounded too with today's day and age. Everything's right at your fingertips. So you expect everything. Okay, oh, I want to know this. I go right on my phone. I want food delivered. I do this. I want to watch this TV and I don't want to watch commercials. It's like nothing is you don't have to work for anything. Like even the simple things like, you know, I don't even have to get up to shut my lights. I clap my freaking hands and, you know, and I'll tell Alexa to do that. You know, it's like, it's all these little things and it just makes it, why, you know, why would I want to do that? You know, why would I want to work?
I have the same thing, like on our podcast, I had a listener that said, you know, can you put at what point you start your content when you guys aren't doing all this other stuff, show stuff. And, you know, and I was getting ready to start doing that. And I'm like, really, man?
No.
You get friggin' free content. Fast forward till you find it, man.
Right. Exactly. You know? Exactly. Exactly. No, I'm with you, man. Yeah. It's just people just don't have the time or the patience to do anything anymore. And it's just a product of our world, you know, like what's going on. I find myself, I get frustrated. My computer doesn't load something in 3 seconds. And I'm like, what the heck? You know? And I'm like, yeah. Dude, it's 3 seconds, literally 3 seconds. Just because it didn't pop up instantly.
I used to do, I was the IT for our school district as well. I taught, I mean, we were a small school district, so you wear all kinds of hats. And
right.
I took care of all the technology. And I took the school from doing 5-part carbons, you know, to do all their POs and do all their paperwork,
uh-huh.
to everything being computer based, right?
Right.
And if the computer or the internet would go down because we were pretty archaic where I live. I mean, it's real rural.
Uh-huh.
But if it went down for a day, they were like, oh, we can't work. And I'm like, you know, you guys were getting more work done in one day on your computer than you were in 5 days the other way.
Right.
You know, so if it goes down every now and then, enjoy the moment.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Enjoy it. Enjoy it. Well, the good thing is what we're going to talk about today. There's no participation trophies.
Absolutely not, man.
If you haven't figured it out, I'm talking with Joe from the Elk Bros. And we're going to talk a little elk today. And he's going to hopefully share with us some good stories and got some teaching moments in him. Why don't you give us a little quick rundown about yourself for those people who don't know who you are?
Yeah, so the name is Joe Gilia. I'm a retired teacher and coach, taught for 30 years, coached for 34 years. I'm still a coach, but I'm no longer coaching. Well, I can't even say kids because a lot of us act like kids, but now I coach elk hunters, man. Elk Bros is basically that's what we are. We are elk hunting coaches, and I have been a professional guide for over 25 years. I've been a bow hunter my whole life. I had a lot of success at bow hunting elk. Elk are my critters. I eat, sleep, and drink elk. Just ask my wife.
Sure, she loves that.
And yeah. And so about 2.5 years ago, we started Elk Bros. I started Elk Bros and pulled in the guys that really influenced me, and as well as my lifelong hunting buddy, Leroy Chavez, who's, we're married to sisters. So we've been best friends, co-coaches, elk hunting buddies for, this will be our 39th season, man. Crazy.
Wow.
Yeah, all of us make up Elk Bros. It was originally created to, I wanted to find a way to pass on the knowledge that I have. People had been on me for that. People that I've guided for over the years, friends of mine, they were like, yeah, you got to do something, Joe, you know, with this knowledge. I think they thought I was going to die, John. I think that's what, so, you know, I didn't know what to do at that time. I was like, I didn't want to write a book, man. I just couldn't do that. And well, fortunately,
nobody will read it anyway because that takes too much effort.
Yeah, you got to have something, you got to have the audio version, right?
Right.
So I said, I'm going to develop an online course and do it in my coaching style, the way and doing the things that have made me successful on coaching kids and coaching people and coaching hunters all of these years, taking those and putting them into a course. And fortunate for me, I taught at the high school. I taught web design, graphic design, video production, broadcasting. So all of this tech internet stuff was like right up my alley. And so I knew that before we got this rolling, this academy, that I was going to have a target audience, going to have a base so that once it was ready that people would know about it. And so at that time, 2.5 years ago, it was like YouTube was like the thing, you know. And then somebody told me about this thing called a podcast. I had never listened to a podcast, man.
Right.
And so I was like, okay, we'll try that. And I got a hold of Gilbert and I was like, and if you haven't listened to our podcast, John, and you don't know Gilbert Ornelas is, That dude could talk the leg off a wooden Indian, man. I mean,
he seems like a fast talker.
He's worked in sales. Yeah, worked in sales in the oil field, in the oil industry. And man, he is just a character. He's charismatic. He's just so Gilbert was all in, and we started that. And I really thought it was going to be the YouTube channel thing that was going to take off, and man, the podcast just blew up. So nice. Here we are 2.5 years later, man. We're doing, and our podcast is called Blue Collar Elk Hunting. You can find anything Elk Bros. You can find our courses and all of our content and other things that we're dabbing in at elkbros.com. So that's who I am, man.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I'm happy to have you on. Yeah, it's funny you said that so many people didn't know what podcasts. I've been doing podcasts since like 11 years ago, 12 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah, before it was popular, you know. So podcasting was like something that Apple came out just for the iPod years ago. and you know, not many people knew about it. Those who, you know, those who had iPods and were in the know for that, you know, genre or whatever were
dating yourself now when you say iPod, dude.
exactly. So I used to do one a month for my the Hunting Channel Online, which is one of the websites that I own, and I did it for a number of years, then I stopped, and then I want to say in 2015 or 2014, I can't remember, 2015, I brought the podcast to the masses, and you know, I actually put it on Apple and iTunes, and kind of just went from there, and it grew and it grew and it grew, and for a long time I was like number two or number three in downloads in the country for hunting, and then all of a sudden out of nowhere all these podcasts started coming out, and you know, Meat Eaters and all that other stuff, and so now it's kind of inundated, it's like flooded the whole market, and that was kind of what happened too with TV. Like, you know, first there was just a number of guys who had a resume, let's say, in hunting, and they got TV shows, and then it became anybody who had enough money to foot the bill for airtime had a TV show, and then everybody started. I started web TV before YouTube. I had the Hunting Channel. That was one of the pioneers in that whole genre of web-based TV shows, you know?
And, oh, that's awesome, man.
Yeah. So there was a part where, time where everybody was doing, everybody was running around filming their hunts and stuff and throwing it up on the internet. So
yeah, especially now, if you have an iPhone, you've got a camera.
Oh, exactly. And there, you can take, I've filmed whole TV shows on an iPhone now. You can make beautiful film. It's crazy. It's crazy how it's all come around full circle, and I went back to podcasting and all that stuff.
You have to realize, living in Cimarron and teaching here for 30 years, our population is like 900. In our high school, grades 9 through 12, we had about 83 kids. So we are rural USA here in Cimarron. Mm-hmm. And, you know, never owned a dish or any of that stuff. So my life was around school and hunting, and I'm either in the woods. So I was pretty oblivious to all of these hunting shows. I still am, pretty much, because I don't watch a lot of TV.
Right.
So I missed out on a lot of that boom and growth and was just doing my thing. But, you know, I tell you, since I started doing a podcast, you know, I always have found that if you want to be good at something, you find people that are good at something and find some of those things that are working and see what you can emulate and go from there. And that's what I've done it with, like with podcasts, listening to some of the people, and man, it's opened up people today. Dude, they have no excuse. The learning curve, the way you can flatten that out, man. Unbelievable.
Yeah. I mean, that's how part of the reason why I started any of this was because I wanted to get better at what I was doing, and I had no way, you know, and other than reading books and magazine articles, you know. So I mean,
I wanted
to get better, right? And
yeah, and those are always limited. Those, I mean, they're stories, so they're limited in, you know, techniques and stuff like that. A lot of times,
yeah, for sure. Well, I guess we should jump into a couple of these stories of yours and see what we can't pull out of them.
Yeah. So, you know, when you sent something to me, you said basically that to talk about some hunts where we learned something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, everything and everybody out there and all, I don't care how long you've been hunting.
Right.
You're here. Every time's a learning moment, man. So what I'm going to try to do, since I am kind of a teacher coach type thing, is I'll kind of tell you, you know, back where one of the biggest, you know, I think that word's epiphany. Am I right with that there, man?
Yep. Epiphany is going.
Yeah. And I'll start with that. And I'd like to even then tell some, because I know our hunters this year, and I'm talking archery as far as that goes right now. And I'm sorry, I lean heavy archery because I don't even own a rifle. Mm-hmm. I guide rifle hunters, but I've never hunted elk myself with the rifle. So I kind of lean heavy archery when I talk about stuff. So I apologize for that to any of those rifle hunters listening. But man, I tell you what, I don't care. You listen to these techniques, you can use them.
Yeah, it's all applicable.
Yeah, absolutely, man. So, you know, I think the hunt that probably was one of the real huge moments for me, beyond the very first time I killed a large bull, because that was a real learning phase, and that was, I learned a lot from that and the things that I did. It was the first time I actually, what I call, put on a show. And you know, basically what I did for that, I had a bull that I started with at 3 o'clock in the morning, in the moonlight with a herd, and just, you know, was just shadowing this herd, waiting for gray light, staying in position, and then trying to see if I could find a way to get this bull just, just sound enormous on there. But I was having to deal with a whole bunch of cows. And for some reason, the way that the satellites were buzzing this dude, and I've never really, this generally doesn't happen. A lot of times these herd bulls are back behind or on one side, but he's always seemed to be on the other side of this herd from me. So I'm still trying to work into him. And from 3 a.m. until, but it was about 10:30, we played cat and mouse. So there's a whole bunch of story and things that happened there, but I'll just tell you about the moment that really got me thinking about things was, I had figured where they were going to go, and I had tried to parallel get around in front, and then get, you know, come in from the side. And as I came over looking to where I knew they were going to be after coming out of this little drainage, I'm like, where the heck are the elk, man? They were gone, and they've been screaming all friggin' morning, man. So I come up and I look back the direction that I had come from hunting, and there they are going in that direction. And I don't know, after you start at 3 a.m. and it's like 10:30, there's just, you get a little frustrated. So I grabbed a branch, and I literally, and we have this real high oak brush with interspersed pines, big pines there. Mm-hmm. And that oak brush is about 8, 10, 12, 15 feet, depending on where you're at. So I just start running with that branch down towards them, and I'm screaming, bugling, I'm cracking stuff with that limb as I'm running down there. And I get down close to this park where I had last seen them, and I stopped just before I got to the edge so I could kind of look out and to see if they were still in that area or if I had managed to pull them or if I just friggin' blew everything up, you know? Mm-hmm. So it was one of these ditch effort frustration things. So when I got there, I looked out, and about 200 yards out in the park, there were two spikes bedded down. And, you know, if you see two spikes bedded down, you know how they are, man. They got to be part of a herd, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
You know, they're going to a lot of times trail behind that bull, and they're not going to get too close, but they want to be with aunt and mama and cousin. And I knew if they were bedded down that the rest of that group wasn't bedded too far. So I came to, and where I'm looking out, I'm like in this taller oak brush, 8 to 10 foot, and you can see through it. I don't know if people have ever been in an oak brush stand, but it's different than just low, thick oak brush. I mean, you can actually see through these trunks, right? So I'm looking out into this small meadow that was real grassy, had a lot of pine and in places, but you could definitely see very well going across there. And I just kind of slipped to the edge, got down on my knees, and I was like, man, I'm just going to try something. So I pulled out three reeds. I laid them on my leg, and I started going in one direction as one small bull, another direction as a medium bull, and then another direction as a bigger bull, and trying to make it sound like a little, you know, basically three bulls that were communicating. Mm-hmm. And we're going to start moving into each other, you know, just amping up.
Basically. What type of bugle were you using, or which bugle sound were you using? I mean, like,
so basically,
or challenging each other, or what were you doing?
So at first, what I did, like I said, I kept the temperature low. So it was just kind of like a location bugle, kind of, where they were kind of answering each other. But what I did was I changed the voice. And I was using three different reeds. I had them laid out. So I wanted one to sound real weak and raggy. Then I just gave just like a regular one. And then I had one with a little bit more rasp in the voice, sound a little bit more mature. Mm-hmm. And I would then, you know, I even spaced their answers out a little bit. You know, so it was like the first one bugled, wait just a few seconds, answer of one, and then wait, and then answer from another one. And then what I started to do was I wanted to seem like three bulls that were communicating, that were coming in and were starting to amp up. And so as they're coming in, I start to actually close that time between the bugles, and I started to make that bigger bull a little bit more, add a little bit more emotion to his, and as they were coming in. And then to the point where, man, now I'm challenge bugling, we're cutting each other off, we're just screaming, the little guy's still squealing just a little bit off, not as jumping in as much as everybody else. So I wanted it to seem like, I don't know, have you ever, you know, being a school teacher, if you want to get everybody to come in to one area, just yell the word fight.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like the whole school, man, is just like right there. So I wanted to make it seem like three guys were coming in for a fight, and then see if anybody's going to come in to watch.
Right.
That was my whole intention at that time. And doing that, I looked out and I saw those spikes snap their head to my right, and then all of a sudden they jumped up and they turned and started to walk away, and I was like, whoa, what's going on here? And I look and I can see legs underneath, because the way the pine trees grow, they're pretty bare on the bottom until about 4 or 5 feet up, and the branches go out. And I don't know if that's from cattle feeding on them or how that happens, but it's almost like you could look through underneath for about 5 foot.
Yep.
And I'm seeing this body coming through of these legs. And I mean, a big body. And I was like, yeah, bud, something's coming, man. He's coming to check out the fight. And at about, I don't know if it was about 80 yards out, John, this guy ducks his head to get it underneath a branch. Mm-hmm. And when I saw that, man, it was like, oh,
my. Game time.
Oh, my. I mean, it was boom, 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 boom. You know, I mean, my doggone heart started coming out my mouth. He was massive. And he kind of stops after he comes to me. He looks over towards my direction. And I'm on my knees. I always, because of the way those pines grow, I will get down on my knees so that I can have the optimum shooting lanes and be able to see the best as possible to get a shot. So I'm down on my knees. I've got my bow up, arrow knocked. I've got a diaphragm in my mouth at this time, but I'm not saying a frigging word at this point. That bull's coming, man. So, he comes in, and it's one of those things that probably took 2 minutes, but it seemed like 30 calendar days, you know?
Right.
It's just watching him come in, and I could swear that he was going to hear my heart coming out my mouth. It was like, and I'm trying to calm myself down, and he comes, John, and he starts to turn broadside. And he's going by one of those pines at 20 yards, and he stops perfectly with the pine trunk in his kill, turning and looking in my direction.
Oh, jeez.
So we're in this stare down mode, right? Well, all I'm trying to do at this time is I'm not even looking at him. When I was a kid, my stepdad used to tell me that animals could feel you looking at them. And I don't know if that was a bunch of BS.
No, I believe it too. And I realized that in the whitetail woods years and years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If you got, if you're waiting for something to come in and you're sitting there in a stand, and if you're staring at them, they just automatically look up at you for some reason. But if you're not looking at them, they don't. It's the weirdest thing ever.
But you know, do you think, and I'll jump back to where I was at, but do you think that that has to do though with how we raise our stress level up? Because at the same time, I've watched animals walk into me where I wasn't hunting them, and I wasn't, you know, worried about having to take a shot, and it seemed like they just kept coming. You know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So so I've got this bull at 20 yards, and see, I shoot instinctively. I shoot a compound, I shoot fingers, bare bow basically. Mm-hmm. And so this bull is standing there, he's looking at me, and I'm looking at the ground at his hooves, and I'm seeing him in my peripheral, and I'm just waiting for him to move. And then he does it, man. He starts to step out. And as soon as he steps out, I know he, as close as we are, because I'm on the edge, I've got stuff behind me to break me up. But between him and me, there's nothing, man. And so I don't know why I did it at that point, but I was like, I've got to hold him for a second. So I screamed a bugle with the diaphragm as I drew. And when I did that, he stopped. And this was the first time that I discovered elk have a fatal flaw. And that is that when they want to see something or to see what spooked them or see what scared them, they almost always stand broadside and turn. In fact, you can booger a bull. Like I could draw with a bull 5 foot in front of me. And a lot of times they'll run if they don't know, if they haven't smelled you and they're not sure what that movement was, they'll run 10, 15, maybe 20 yards, stop broadside and look at you, you know? So that bull, as I drew and I came back, he stops, he freezes, and I'm looking at my spot, and I don't, at that time, I didn't even remember releasing the arrow. I could just, in slow-mo, see that just passing through him. So that's the biggest bull that I've ever arrowed in my life. Mm. He ended up scoring 351.
Nice.
And, I mean, just a beautiful – I don't know if you've ever seen the Gila bulls, how rough they are in New Mexico, but he's got the same texture. Yeah, just gorgeous, man. So this was the first time that I had discovered putting on a show, and it was something that – I had to really think about and that I had to look at. And I mean, this is young in my elk hunting career. I think I was, I don't know, I was probably like 24, 23 at the time. Mm-hmm. So I'm really young in my elk hunting career and developing my techniques and my know-how and stuff. So fast forward some years later when I'm hunting with Chav, do you have any questions about that though?
I think you were doing a really good job of explaining it well, but I'm, you know, sometimes I have to take off my, I got to put on a different hat and think about how other guys would perceive it. But I think everything you said to me seems kind of, I don't want to say no brainer, but it makes a lot of sense. Like everything you did, you know, you wanted, you, when you ran down to the elk, you were making it sound like you were, you know, a bull rushing in, or maybe even a couple elk coming down to meet up with the herd or whatever. Mm-hmm. It just, all of it made sense to me, but I guess I wasn't looking at it from somebody who might not know. I guess, I don't know. I was just really intently listening to the story, so I didn't write anything down. But
no, it's cool, man. That means you were in the moment, man. That's
I was trying to picture everything. I was trying, because we had that same oak brush here in Arizona. You know, that same thick. It's actually a little shorter here. I don't think we ever get like 15 foot high, but you know, it's usually 5 to 8. But it's enough to hide behind. I know. I was trying to picture all this and like put myself in that situation. So.
Yeah. And actually that stuff, I mean, oak brush areas, especially when you get those tall stands mixed even with the lower stuff so that it gets super thick, is one of my favorite places to bow hunt, because everything's going to be up close and personal. You can make a lot of noise when you're talking to them because those elk want to visually confirm, you know, but at this time they're not smelling, they're hearing that it sounds like another elk. They're hearing you walking around it, you know, so not only are you verbalizing like another elk, you're walking around like another elk. Mm-hmm. And when they do get in that point to where they can try to visually see, I mean, you're talking 10, 15, 20 yard shots, you
right,
know, so
right. They're it's already in the kill zone. So
yeah, it's yeah. nice and tight. It's nice and tight. And what I like about it. So you take that, and there was a lot of growth from that and a lot of development, but there was another hunt that really made me think about some things as well. And Machab and I, we had moved up from some of that oak brush to where it transitions into real thick, like jack pines and regular pines. So mm-hmm. it doesn't open up. There's still a lot of cover inside there. And we are basically moving up with a herd of elk that had come from their nighttime bed. We're transitioning through the brush and moving up onto a ridge, basically. Mm-hmm. And as they were doing that, we are, again, trying to get in a parallel position. I hate to trail elk. Number one, there's always stragglers that end up busting you. If the thermals end up switching you, it's going right up to them. And then, dude, it's like if there is a straggler, the whole, you know, you end up pegged down with that one while the whole herd's moving forward. And it's so hard to keep up with them. So I've always, since I first started chasing these critters, found out that I was way more effective being on the side of them. In fact, a lot of times what would happen is because things are larger at the bottom of hills and get smaller at the top, a lot of times we'd end up converging at some point and be right. in a great situation at the same level, right?
Right,
So we're doing this and we're working with these elk and we get into this thick stuff and I had thrown some cow calls back, hoping to try to, and because I had the cows talking to me, the bull was bugling. He was doing some location bugles and stuff, but it didn't really seem like he was interested. It seemed like, you know, I've got my ladies. I could care less that there's another cow out there. So I'm just moving along. Well, as luck have it, because I'm paralleling this guy, there is a bull trailing him that is now starting to challenge, doing some lip balls, some different things. Evidently, there was a cow in heat because, I mean, it was starting to light up other bulls around this. So mm-hmm. when this happens, the cows could care less. They're moving up, but that bull's stopping every now and then, and he's kind of like challenging back, and there got to be a gap between him and his cows. Mm-hmm. And since we were paralleling and I saw this, I just kind of slipped right in between, gave a cow call, and this guy, oh, well, there's one of my ladies, man. I better get there. So he comes in, comes through a small oak brush patch, which let me draw. I end up shooting him at 10 yards and dropping him and within sight, just right there. So even though that was a cool success story, the learning moment came after that because – as we moved into the herd, Chav and I had gotten separated, and he ended up moving off to another bull that was sounding off, and here I am with one on the ground. Well, I have this distinct type bugle that I do a lot of times, especially when I want Chav to know where I am. It's a double bugle, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'll do a kind of a location bugle, and as I'm coming down, I go right back with a scream. Right. I mean, so it's, you know, it's like starting to come down and then just right back at it. It almost sounds like one bull cutting another bull off. Right.
Okay, cool.
So Chav knows that bugle and he knows it's me. So I'm at this doggone, I've got my bull down in front of me and I'm like getting ready to start working the bull. And I'm trying to get Chav to come in so he can help me pack this bull out.
Right.
Right. So I start screaming double bugles.
Okay.
Obnoxiously. I mean, scream, double scream, work the bull a little bit, double scream, work the bull a little bit, double scream. Before Chav got there, John, I called in four other bulls.
That's awesome.
And when that happened, I was like, why in the heck is that going on? And what I, it was kind of like what I talked to you about before, about a everybody fight. Coming to watch a fight, yep. right? But what I figured is, and I've also found that when I am following a bull and we're trying to parallel it and worrying about that he's moved off in a different direction, trying to get him to sound off, or if they're moving a lot faster and the wind is blowing and it's real hard to tell what direction they're moving and where it's coming from, and you would throw out a location bugle hoping that it would answer and you could, you know, get a bead and go get on him. Well, there were times when they just wouldn't answer.
Mm-hmm.
But I would throw out that double bugle, boom, almost every time, man. And my hypothesis to this is that when you throw out a location bugle to another and another bull hears that, he's got to decide whether or not he wants to engage with you. And right. sometimes they just don't want to engage, right? And he's happy in his situation. He's got his cows are around him. He knows where they are, because a lot of guys think when they're being answered by a location bugle from a bull or herd bull or bull that's, you know, that has his cows moving, is that that bull's talking to him, and they're not, they're just sounding off where they're at. So the cows know, right?
Right. Or, you know, or they're roundup bugling or whatever to move the cows, yeah. whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But it has really, it's more about him and his ladies than it has anything to do with you.
Right.
Right. So what I, when I would double bugle, my hypothesis is that this bull would now hear a bull that sounds off and another one that just blows right at him. So these are two bulls engaged with each other and not engaged with him, but yet, I mean, when you have two bulls sounding off, there's a couple of things that could be happening. There could be a hot cow over there.
Right.
There could be a mature bull over there because he's being very aggressive that could pull his ladies off of him. So I think instead of him having the fight or flight thing, I think he is basically going, oh, wait a second. I'm here, y'all. I'm you don't need to go over that way. I'm here. I'm the man. So I think it just kind of makes him have to step up and make a noise, or he could possibly lose his cow. So that's right. my theory.
Right. right. It's like being in a crowd of people and, you know, you're the supposed head honcho, and then some pipsqueak pipes off at you and you don't say nothing to him. And you're like, then everybody starts looking at you like, well, are you going to say something? Like that, yeah. that pipsqueak is saying something to you, you know?
He's talking trash to you, man.
Yeah, 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 step exactly.
Up. Yeah. yeah. But see, the problem is with the single bugle, that's like, let's say you're following or paralleling a herd, and it's so hard sometimes. I mean, it's so hard not to, because you're like, well, did they disappear? Did they stop? Did they move over a ridge? So sometimes you get like real paranoid and you're like, I just need to hear a noise. Right.
Right.
The problem with that is if they're off enough and they're not hearing a cow call, it's hard, or a calf call, it's hard for you to use that to get them to sound off. And so you're like, man, now I throw out a bugle. Well, that's a double-edged sword, because, yeah, I'm going to find out where he's at, but he's going to know that I'm here and that I'm following as well. And, you know, he's going to possibly urge those cows to move a little faster. He's going to throw a roundup bugle, and you're thinking and he's going to answer you, and he's actually, let's get out of here. Let's move. So in helping yourself locate, you hurt yourself in pushing them out, right? So that's where that double bugle for me was kind of a little bit of an answer, mm-hmm. so that they didn't feel so intimidated, hopefully, because it doesn't always work that way.
Do you don't happen to have your bugle tube with you, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I have it here.
Okay. Go ahead and blast that out. Let's hear it.
Oh, you want to hear it?
Yeah, let's do it. I could tell, because I know I was thinking it the whole time. I want to hear it. I know the listeners are going to be like, oh, let's see what this sounds like.
All right. Here we go. Be kind of like that, man.
Cool.
Yeah. And you could even, and I don't worry about, I'm not, like, I hear a lot of guys that they spend so much time on the south end. Like that.
Right.
There's no way they're going to get to a double bugle.
No, you got
when they do it.
You don't have enough air in your lungs.
Yeah. And really, the sound they're going to hear is that high pitch anyway. So it's... So I get that in there, and that's like, man, you can just hear two other bulls engaging, you see?
Nice. I just added that to my toolbox, just so you know.
Yeah, and so here... That epiphany to me was this, and it started to grow into another whole different area for me, was that there's two types of calls. You have calls that are in where you're engaging a bull, mm-hmm. and calls where you're non-engaging. And that became key to me was, in other words, I'm ignoring my target animal. And by ignoring him, I'm not threatening him. I'm not engaging him in any way. And that's the idea I got from that double bugle. And it started to get me to expand into other things. So that's where anything you want to add or ask me about that?
No, I that makes perfect sense to me because, well, I guess I'll add something to that. It's, drop into a canyon and there's like bulls bugling in every direction and cow sounds in every direction. And then you try to call something, you're just another call. You're just another elk talking and you're right. Not necessarily engaging in anything or directly engaging with anything. And right. I learned it the hard way because I'd get into the situation like, oh, this is the best thing ever. There's so many elk. Which way do I go? Like, you know, and then it took some years of realization. And actually, Paul Medell made it more clear to me a few years ago. I did a podcast with him and I was talking to him about one of my Utah elk hunting, and that was in 2016 or mm-hmm. no, it was 2017. And it took me till then to figure that out. Like I didn't really, I would just follow bugles at that point, if I got into that situation, cause I knew they wouldn't engage with me vocally or directly, and they weren't going to come in cause there was too much going on. But,
right.
And then I started doing things that made everybody in the party focus on me. And then I made that realization, I'm like, all right, how do I be the cool kid? How do I be the one that everybody else that's talking in this club over here amongst themselves are going to focus on me? And, I started doing things that like, all right, well, let me, I tried the breeding sequence stuff and that works really great too. But as it was, how do I went back to when I was in my 20s, right? And I was like,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What did I do? I knew instinctively, like, I got to do something to stand out here. I'm not the best looking dude in this place. There's so many people here. There's like, what do I need to do? And so I started looking at it through those optics. And
right.
once I started doing that, I was able to start pulling elk my way. And every situation is different, so I can't like give you like a recipe, but I
just... No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, you got to find the button.
Right? Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But basically, there is kind of a formula of knowing... Well, the key is the cow, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is the key. All of these guys are out there because they want a hot cow.
Right.
So that's key. And if you understand that and you understand what's driving them and you understand how they're going to react and what the calling is all about, when they call and why they call, mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden you can do things like you said to be that cool kid all of a sudden. Because for me, because of that in New Mexico, we have a hunt unit. It's not like Colorado where if you're hunting OTC, you can go to any OTC unit. You have that hunt unit, and that hunt unit a lot of times is divided by a fence.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a small enough area, what you end up with is sometimes elk will be on you, sometimes they'll be on the other side, right. And you're left over there, you know, listening to the party on the other side. Mm-hmm. And so what do? Okay, I'm going to scream a challenge bugle. Okay, he's like a half mile away, and you're screaming a challenge bugle. Big friggin' deal, right? Yeah, ain't nothing going to happen. Yeah. You can do a cow call. That ain't going to work. He's got plenty of cows with him, you know. So basically, you're pleading with that situation on the other side with tool sets that aren't going to work. And So out of necessity, we had it. I was like, well, dude, man, I know that herd bull has 3-4 satellites around him, you know, that either they've gotten their butt kicked all night, or they're still buzzing him, or, you know, they want a hot cow.
Right.
And so why don't I give them some other fruit that might be low hanging that they might have an option for if this one, the other one's not working. So we started putting on our own party. We started, you know, playing the parts of several bulls or a bull with a hot cow, and kind of like what I told you I did with that first time, right? So kind of making multiple bulls coming into an area and with cow talk. And then again, like you said, depending on the situation, like sometimes if I saw that they had other cows that were starting to get interest come my way, I would like use a lost cow or a lost calf going in between, because I deflect a lot of my calls away from the animals I'm trying to bring to me, because I don't like them to think I'm closer than what I am, right?
Right.
So then I could turn and I actually physically move a lot on one side of the ridge to back, but I would come further up and I'd sound like a lost cow looking for somebody, you know, and all of a sudden those other bulls like, whoa, you know, Lucy's lost, man. That might be an easy pickup. And the other thing I would do is, like, I would actually sound like a herd that was moving away from them, where most callers always are coming in.
Right.
And coming in. And I would actually take it so they would, like, move like they were going away on the ridge, come back to the top of the ridge, start to move away again, so that it wasn't the typical scenario. It wasn't that same old rodeo that the elk heard all the time.
Right.
And in doing that, dude, I have been so successful at bringing elk from half mile, 3/4 mile away and coming in to different scenarios that we do. And
nice.
That totally changed, because what I'm doing is I'm not engaging at all with that.
Yeah, you actually made me think of a story myself. So one of the units that we have, so Arizona's the same situation as you. We have a unit, we have to stick to it. We have a couple of units that are trophy units that are bordering reservation and stuff like that. So there's literally a fence. You get to the fence and there's giant bulls on the other side of the fence, and you know, you want to get them to come to you. And I did something very similar to what you were just saying. I would start at the fence, sort of, you know, not right on the fence, but, and I would call, and then I'd walk away 100 yards, whatever, and then I'd call again. And I kept going back and forth, and then I would slide it like 50 yards, 40 yards every time, till eventually, you know, I could hear the elk getting closer and closer and closer, that in order for them to come see me or come find out what's going on, they would have had to come over the fence. And we were able to call this bull, and my client shot it. Unfortunately, we didn't recover that bull, but it just happened to be what happened. And it was just, but I was like, wow, that worked, you know. It's something I had never tried before, and I was like, well, that worked. We need to think about this next time we're in a situation where, you know, that you need them to come even further. You know, because in a normal situation, we would have, you know, probably pressed up on them and gotten closer, but we couldn't physically get any closer.
Well, have you ever had it happen to you? Like, you have a bull that sounds off, and you start working into that bull, and he starts to come into you, but then all of a sudden, he seems like he just stops at 150, and he's like, no, you come to me, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, all the time.
Yep. And you're doing this thing back and forth. And you're like, screw you, because I hear another bull over here. So you start to, you leave him and you start calling at the other bull that you're going to. And then all of a sudden this guy sounds off behind you 150 yards and you've just moved 400 yards. Mm-hmm. And then you keep going again and you sound off and he's again 100. It's like he's interested. He's coming, but he's like, well, you know, I'm not sure of this situation. Right. You know, that's a great way that you can leave a partner behind and move off and have him come into him. But that was another one of those things, you know?
Yeah. If you're buddy calling, then, you know, you got the option to go really far back. And then once you realize they're coming too, you can, you know, come back a little bit. It's a little harder to direct the elk to where where your partner is going to be at that point. Cause it's, you know, it's much broader spectrum,
it was the same principle, because I was engaging that other new bull, bugling him moving that direction, and this guy's like just in tow the whole time, man. So again, those things kind of give you that message. And so I wanted to, you know, I told you earlier, I wanted to give a nugget because we have the full moon coming up, and mm-hmm. this was actually on one of my guide trips that this happened. And, you know, we were having the full moon and the elk are out in the middle of this park. I mean, just it's September 20th. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's right on the equinox. They're going nuts. And there's several herd bulls with cows out in this large park. And I know that they're going to move up. You know, once it starts getting light, they're not going to stay down there very long. Mm-hmm. And so we were in a tough situation, because at that point you're like around the park. It's like, well, where do I go? Because if I get ahead of them and they come up my direction with the thermals, we're screwing ourselves. So you got to kind of stay on the side a little bit, kind of see how they're moving, where they're going to move in, and then again try to get up on their level or get on their side and maybe pull that guy over. Well, you know, I cow called one time just to let them know that there was a cow over in this area. Again, knowing that those cows are going to move up and the bulls are going to follow, but maybe there might be a satellite or something that could come off that. So they are doing exactly as planned. They are moving up into the trees. And as they're doing it, you know, I'm cow calling and this guy is just like, whoa, whoa. I just answer him like, oh man, we might get this to happen, you know? And I mean, it is just lighting up all in this park, going up into the trees, so many bulls. It's one of those things where you're like, God, which one do I go for, man? You know, mm-hmm. So as they're going up and it sounds like the bull's really interested, the problem is, again, I'm one cow. He's got 10 or 15 in front of him. He's not going to leave them. Mm-hmm. So here's where the things start to happen. Because those elk all move up and basically hit the hills into the trees going up. They're sounding off as they go. We managed to kind of stay on the side of one group, but I ended up in a bad position with a park between me and them, a long thin park. So I really couldn't do anything. And I knew, you know, that they weren't going to, he wasn't going to come back to me. Wasn't no way. But I could see then some satellites moving in on him up ahead. And as the elk moved up in the trees, as loud and as much as everything was sounding off, it hit that magic time and it was like there wasn't a single elk in the woods. It just shut up.
Southwest curse, man. Arizona, New Mexico, it's like, I don't know the time exactly, but I'm going to say 10:30, because that seems to be one of those times. But 10:30, 11 o'clock, and then boom. Like, they could have been the biggest show going on ever.
Ever.
And they don't make a sound. And they won't make a sound again until evening, like, no matter what you do. Although I'll share something with you off air that
so hold I found that out. Thought. Hold that thought. This is where I'm going to hand out a nugget right here, man. So, yeah, you're exactly right. And for us, it was 9:30. It seemed like at 9:30, everything just like, boom, just shut up, right? Uh-huh. And I know that these, you know, if I was somebody that had just walked into the woods without having seen what I saw and heard what I heard,
right,
you would have thought there's not an elk in the woods. And that's a huge message I want all of our listeners to hear, is that a lot of times we go out and we sound off, we give all these great calls. You can sound as great as you want and as enticing as you want, and it's crickets. And right. We think there's no elk in the woods, and the woods can be chock full. So the good thing was my hunter knew that elk were there because he had just seen it. And it was an easy convince when I told him, look, these guys are going up. They're going to be just go right up on the top of these hills here. They're going to bed down. Some of them are still going to be moving. Just stick with me. I've got a plan. And so what I did was I knew that where the elk was at that time, they like to move around those, what I call the knuckles. So where those finger ridges go up and they all kind of join up, mm-hmm. you have kind of like the knuckles on your hand where things kind of join. So I moved up high enough to where I was pretty much in that knuckle area where you're not really having to drop down real deep into each finger mm-hmm. when you're crossing them. But my plan was to basically now be a herd bull with a cow or some cows that was moving across the ridges. Mm-hmm. So what I did at that point was I would give just a small location bugle, just like a bull with cows inside. But I very seldom did it. Every now and then I would do just a small bugle or I would do a chuckle. But most of my noises were, I throw out a couple of cow calls, but most of my noises were. Yeah. You know, those types of noises and the
glunking. Yeah.
So I was glunking and sounding like a bull behind a cow moving to bed or cows moving to bed that was frustrated, man, and just trailing this cow. And I just kept working across as I was doing this. Well, it, again, crickets for a long ways, but I continued because I wanted to put out that image into any elk, any bull's mind that he could peg which direction I was moving, how I was moving, that it was a cow, and that it was a frustrated bull with a cow that was possibly in heat as I'm moving. And because that cow's wanting to move and not going to stop, I'm frustrated because she won't breed. She just keeps moving, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'm doing this. And as I'm doing this, I could swore one time up ahead, I heard a chuckle. And that was it. And I was like, well, that has possibilities. So I just keep doing that as I'm going. And even like sometimes you add that little as I'm going along, right? Mm-hmm. Well, I come to this one finger ridge, getting ready to drop down, and I did some glunking. I gave a little cow call, and up above me, about 200 yards, a small bugle comes out. And I'm like, dude, that's that same guy that chuckled. He's now moved down even further. I said, let's do this. So I put my hunter down in the bottom, where it comes off of that. We were almost right to where in the bottom of that small drainage or that area where you're crossing from one finger to the other, mm-hmm. it came to a point to go up into the trees again. So it was a natural funnel from where that bull was. So I go and drop him down in the bottom and I cross over to the top of the other ridge and I start now putting on a little scenario that I'm that bull and I'm starting to disappear over the next ridge. And I kind of stopped a little bit, did some glunking, did a couple of cow calls, really sounded frustrated. And then all of a sudden, I hear exactly what I had been doing happen. I mean, I'm hearing crashing up on the top, like going through the logs and the branches up there. It was basically the feet of elk. And then I hear that son of a gun doing this exact. He was. I hear that with crashing coming right down the hill, and this cow elk pops out 15 yards in front of my hunter, looks up at the ridge at me, starts to come up to where I'm at up there and almost pegs me. She's like, I had to shut up at that point. And she kind of goes down below me about 15 yards and keeps on going. Perfect situation. That bull makes the same noise, comes out and stands broadside for my hunter at 15 yards.
Beautiful.
Broadside. And a beautiful, beautiful bull right there. And now, so as the story goes, my hunter does not shoot this bull. Because he's a very inexperienced hunter,
okay,
and he wasn't sure if that was a big enough bull.
Okay.
So he doesn't end up shooting it. And I'm like, I stopped this bull because this bull was, he was over 350 easy. Oh, Jesus. I mean, just, yeah. But, you know, I mean, look, for a lot of those people out there that have never been in a situation with an elk and they don't understand what an elk looks like, you know, it's hard for you and me as we take things for granted.
Right.
And let me tell you, it was hard for me at first when I finally got down and I'm like, what happened? You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we don't end up taking that bull, but I wanted to pay attention first to that, how I got that to work. Right.
Right.
So I continue doing this and we work over the ridge and we go into this other area and because I'm doing the same thing, all of a sudden two bulls sound off up ahead of me. And when they sounded off like that, I was like, whoa, we have a little competition. They hear this guy and they think that I have a hot cow and they're starting to light up.
Mm-hmm.
And perfect situation. And so I shut up at that point and we moved up ahead trying to cut it. And we hit again another situation where we would have gone into an open park trying to stay into the trees from where they were across from us. But it was the perfect thing, John, because we had a change in terrain. Where we were at, it had a little bit of a rise in front of us where I could not see what was ahead. So I was like, we're stopping right here.
That's my favorite.
Oh, it is so awesome. And a lot of people, you know, they want to visually see the animal coming in and they end up blowing it for themselves, right? So I just get down right there. I get him set up. I go a little bit. I point my grunt tube back behind, give a little cow call, and I can hear running footsteps. And this guy comes over the top and stops and looks at us, man, trying to figure out where is that cow. Once he gets to what I call the stop and scan position, you know, where he can see where they should be. And he starts to get a little bit edgy. Because I'm sitting there, I'm calling out the range to my hunter, you know, trying to tell him. And so he's like, and he turns broadside a little bit, maybe slight quartering away. And I just gave a little, yeah, he stops and it was done deal.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Was he bigger?
So
was he bigger than the first one?
He was not.
Damn.
And this bull scored, I think it was 330 something. This bull scored. And my hunter was just, you know, thrilled to death with it. And I was like, the other one was bigger. So
yeah, it happens. Usually it goes the other way around, but
yeah. No, and you know, anytime you're with an inexperienced young, you know, in as far as hunting elk goes,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's such a cool revelation to see all the new things that they're learning and that they're trying to soak up and how they don't want to mess up. And, you know, it's their learning path. It's their journey. And to be part of that and to see how ecstatic they are. And yeah, you know, even awesome. In that one bull that we didn't shoot, what an experience,
right?
Man.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Exactly.
Yeah. So, as far as I was concerned, I counted coup on that animal. You know what I mean? So it was, yeah, it's so cool to watch that.
No, that's awesome. I had some good takeaways from this story. So one, that you recognize the funnel, which comes with experience. I actually did a seminar last year with West Coast Archery on that exact subject. You know, the hang up spots, all that stuff. And the stuff that you were describing to me, you know, with looking, recognizing a funnel, okay, this is a great spot for us to set up. And then having a rise and not going over to the top. Cause everybody, like you said, most guys will want to go over that rise. But
right,
just like you have the desire to go peek over the top,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that bull has to
same, come. Same, same.
Yeah, has to come over the top to see what's calling. The hang up spot is, you know, is over the top, already in your kill zone.
Yep.
Where if you were to go over the top, who knows how much empty space or whatever you had where he could have hung up, you know, at 100 yards or 90 yards or whatever, 80 yards, something that's not a makeable shot with a bow. And
yeah,
so, you know, rifle, different scenario. Maybe you'd want to go sit up the top and just, you know, lay down and have the have a bird's eye view of everything.
Absolutely.
But
absolutely,
with a bow, yeah, you know, exactly the way that you described it, it's like,
yeah, and I've always called it that stop and scan, and yeah, and I always try to tell people if they want to visualize it, it's kind of like when you're doing a setup, it's kind of like you going in your house and you know your wife is someplace in the house, but you're not sure which room,
yeah,
that she's in, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you call out and you hear a voice, but you're not sure, you're going to go and you're going to go to the doorway and you're going to stop and look in. Oh, they're not there. So you're going to go to the next doorway. You're going to stop and look in. So that's exactly what those elk are doing. If you can figure, well, and make sure that where that stop and scan location is going to be in your effective shooting range, man, you've just set it up. You know, right, you're perfect. Once they hit that, now that elk's going to make some decisions, and that elk is either going to make a decision that, I don't see anything, I'm going to get bored and I'm going to turn to go away, or they're going to keep coming forward. If they start to turn to look away, man, that's a gimme right there, because again, they have a fatal flaw. Just throw out a grunt, scream a bugle, stop that animal, and it will stop broadside, man. And if he keeps coming forward, now things can get a little bit more dicey depending on how he comes in, if he comes at you straight on or not.
Right, right.
But yeah, but no. It's so huge, man. Because I think, John, a lot of people end up in great, great situations where they don't understand how to set up, that not setting up properly is probably one of the number one reasons for a lot of people not scoring.
It's more important than being able to be a good caller. I mean, you could be a mediocre, you know, making sounds.
Mm-hmm, wise. Sure.
The setup is everything. I believe setup, and that seminar that I was talking about, I talk about it being the commonality that links all calling, whether it's turkey, deer, predators, elk, it has everything to do with the setup, and the setup is key. So if you guys want to see that, it's on my YouTube, from last year.
Oh, cool.
It's definitely on there, and you can visualize what you know, Joe and I are talking about.
So is your YouTube channel under John Stallone, or is it?
Yeah, you could do John Stallone. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. I'll send you that link if you want to look at it. But
sure. I just want to make sure people listening go find it easy as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny. I'm not sure who sometime is doing this podcast, because
I know you're so doing a better. You can always tell when you're doing a podcast with somebody who does this podcast.
Yeah.
But no, thanks. I appreciate it. Good looking out.
And, and there's one thing, you know, when you mentioned funnel like mm-hmm. that, I mean, I'll give you another good example. We were just scouting the last 3 days for the first time ever. I've been a school teacher, been a coach, and, you know, a blue collar elk hunter, mm-hmm. poor man elk hunter forever. And so I've never hunted out in New Mexico. And for the first time ever, Elk Bros is taking the show on the road, and we're hunting up in Colorado this year.
Oh, nice.
And so I just came back from a 3-day scouting trip, and I was with one of our new Elk Bros coaches, Cole Wilkes. And, you know, the way I scout is different than the way a lot of people scout, I think, because what I'm looking for. And, you know, I'm really checking to find out where I'm looking for, where cow sign is, where tracks are. I'm looking for what the feed looks like, what the moisture looks like. I don't even own a game cam. I've never used a game cam. Mm-hmm. I'm not looking for bulls. I'm wanting to find out what the lay of the land looks like, where some of the holes can be. And I'm covering a lot of country and looking at different things that would tell me to look here. Like, for example, as me and Cole were traveling. On one side, there was a log across the road, and there was a sign, a National Forest sign, that said roads closed, you mm-hmm. know? And so I immediately stopped right there and went to go walk up that road. And I did a little video piece where I explained to people, I said, you know, you can be on a main road and never see a track, but some of the best places to go and check, because elk always like the path of least resistance, mm-hmm. is on some of these closed roads. And I hadn't walked up in there 50 yards and there were cow tracks going right down it. And then as we were going further, off to our right-hand side was a little small drainage that had water in it. And as we were driving, most of the hillside had been kind of elevated where we were driving. And all of a sudden there was this little dip. And I stopped right there, and like I told Cole, I was like, Cole, check out this. This is, when we talk about saddles, people always envision only tops of mountains. But again, elk like the path of least resistance that funnels them. And this low area between hills from that drainage, and it was a low level area. I mean, it wasn't like a deep drainage. It was just an area that had a little park in it with mm-hmm. water in it. It was a perfect, you know, area for elk to move through. And sure enough, you know, there were tracks from where they were using that. So, you know, if people start to think how they would, if they were someplace and you're tired, you're hungry, do you want to go up on the side of a hill, you know, or do you want to find the best path to move through? And elk move the exact same way. They are masters at saving energy, yep. unless they're in a situation where they have to do something different, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yep. Without a doubt. Well, Joe, I want to thank you for coming on. This was, I definitely want to have you back on. Somebody just rang my doorbell here. My dog's going nuts. I definitely want to have you back on eventually, and we'll do a little bit more traditional tactics type podcast.
And, sure.
So I'm unfortunately going to have to rush you off here because there's somebody knocking on my door. But
hey, that's all right, dude.
It was good having you on, and we'll talk to you soon, bud.
Thanks for inviting me, John. Right. And you take care, bro.
Have a good one. Thanks. Bye. Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to check out daysinthewild.com. And be sure to give us a review on iTunes. Thank you, and we'll check you out on the next episode.